a lot of things are going to happen tonight. We're going to talk to people all night. This is going to last 14 hours. We're going to talk to people about homelessness. We're going to talk to experts about various aspects of homelessness. We're going to talk to homeless people. I'm going to take your calls from around the country. But the first thing I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to light a memorial candle that's here in front of me. And this candle is for all of the homeless people who have died out in the cold. It's a very cold night tonight. And let's remember that in this very night, while we're talking tonight, there may well be one or two or three or more homeless people quietly freezing to death somewhere in this land. And that's a disgrace and a shame that we must do something about. And tonight, I'm going to do something I've never done before at a homelessness marathon. I'm going to light a second candle. And this second candle is for the six brave firefighters who died in Worcester, Massachusetts, in a failed attempt to rescue two homeless people who they thought were in a burning building. You know, we have a lot of people in this society who don't care much about the homeless, and the homeless will tell you that if you have a problem, you can't really call the police, and the courts are not necessarily friendly, and God knows the politicians aren't too friendly. But those firefighters in Worcester were people we can all be proud of. Chief Dennis L. Budd of the Worcester Fire Department said, "We didn't draw the line whether the people were homeless or had the largest bank accounts in the world. When a human life is involved, we don't put a price on it." Well, good for the firefighters. We are honored to have them among us. And in my mind, they stand for the best of America. They stand for the fact that all over this country, there are still people who care.
Mm-hmm. I learned a lot. Homeless people, they stick together. They look out for each other. I learned a lot about people, about being homeless, how they care for each other, sir.
Do you think homeless people care for each other more than people with houses do?
Yes, they do. They got a bond. I can't explain it, sir. I don't know how to explain it. They got a bond. I don't know. They're real tight. They look out for each other. They feed each other. They make sure that you're comfortable and this and that. They look out for each other. They got a bond.
Captain Windham, is this something you've seen? You're shaking your head.
Oh yeah. There's a tremendous bond, and there's a tremendous networking system among the homeless people, and there is a unique bond there that they share with each other, and they really watch out and they care for each other. And I think in that respect, maybe many of us can take a lesson from them.
Let's just suppose you could do everything you wanted. How much more money do you need than what you're getting?
Actually, I've never figured it out that way. I'd say certainly if we had 10 times as much money, you know, that would address the problem. I did read a figure just the other day in talking about a specific segment of the population providing affordable housing for families with children who have one wage earner or working but cannot afford housing. And for that, it would take a little more than four times as much as the president is proposing in an increase this year to address the affordable housing need just for that portion of the population that now cannot afford their housing.
But you're saying it could be by as much as a factor of 10 times what you're getting now to do the job.
Definitely.
Now, just to go back to something Esther said, in the last HUD survey, or actually it wasn't their survey, but they commissioned it, 44% of the people who are in shelters, I guess, or getting homeless assistance services are actually employed. And in that same survey, another 23% are minor children who can't be employed.
Right.
So we're talking already two-thirds of the homeless are either employed or minor children who we can't expect them to be getting a job. Now, as I understand it, Gene, the U.S. Conference of Mayors just did a study on requests for shelter and food assistance in cities across the country. And what did you find?
Well, we did that. You said cities across the country, we only did it in 26 cities. We reported on 26 cities. And what we find was an increase in both requests for both homelessness and requests for food in these cities. 12% average increase in requests for homelessness and for emergency food, and 18% increased over the last year. A lot of the cities respond that just welfare reform itself has had a tremendous impact in terms of the numbers that they report. This is the a large part of the reason for this increase in both food requests and emergency homeless requests. There's no doubt about it, although we cannot statistically quantify that, we know that it has a major impact.
Jamie, well, welcome to the homelessness marathon. Are you a homeless person?
Yes, I am. I went from welfare to work. I went to a low income job, and I lost it because the welfare department wanted me to go through a temp service. Well, temp services don't provide you with full-time work, and if you lose your job, you don't get unemployment, and they can lower your hours whenever they want to. Once you lose your job, you lose your apartment. And yes, that was a big problem, affordable housing. I didn't have none. Also, daycare. Now, daycare was another story because when I found my job, they wanted nighttime work through the temp service. Well, they don't provide 24-hour daycare services around town. And it comes...
Well,
hello?
Go ahead.
They do not have 24-hour daycare services unless you pay for it, and I'm not rich. Subsidized daycare has laws and regulations, and you can only get 8 hours. So if I wanted to go to school, I would actually couldn't go to school because they would only provide you with 8 hours. So I would only get 8 hours daycare. I couldn't have 16 hours of daycare subsidized. I couldn't go to school because they wanted me to go to work. If you see my reasoning here.
So I understand. And what you're saying, if I understand it correctly, and someone else has talked about this before, is that it's a quick fix at any price, get you working at any price, and they don't really seem to care whether the particular job you have is a solution to your problem or not. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And the factories where I worked at was through the welfare department, and they were only temp services, which provided factories were through the temp services, which was not a full-time job. And the daycares, if I wanted to go to work and go to school at the same time, I couldn't. When you become homeless, they automatically put you in a mental, like you're mentally disabled. And I'm not mentally disabled. But when you're homeless, they want to make you to be mentally ill.
We're starting our winter meeting here at the Conference of Mayors tomorrow. And I'm certainly going to bring this case up to Housing and CD Committee members tomorrow when we meet, at least some of the members, and at least talk about this kind of situation and how we can deal with these kind of things. One of the things that is shocking to me, and I didn't notice at all that I've learned a great deal just listening to those who are homeless on this program is classifying or saying someone is mentally disabled because they are homeless. That is shocking to me that that one would have to go through that kind of thing simply because one finds themselves in a predicament that any of us could find ourselves in if we didn't have a job, if we didn't have certain means. It is really something that is appalling, I think, in this nation.
Can you tell people what kinds of problems you experience?
Well, I've had psychosis, and I've had depression and stuff. I guess there's a lot of mentally ill that are homeless, and uh I guess if there's any of them listening right now, I'd like to say that there is going to be an answer to these problems, and that everybody needs to work together, because this earth of ours is all one home, and we're all children of one God, and we need to realize that we all have the right to have shelter and food and clothing, and all of our basic needs met, and that we shouldn't feel guilty about having a place to live and things like that.
Eddie, Robbie, in your time on the streets, have either of you run into homeless families?
Yes, every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, and I go to the Catholic Worker House, you know, sometime, and it's frustrating, because if there's no help for them and their families, you know, and it makes me wonder, you know, will I ever get any help? And I'm single.
And what about the issue about politics, though? Do either of you have any political outlook from your experience on the streets? Are you Democrats? Are you Republicans? Would either one of you support one of the parties?
I'd say I'm for anarchy organized by the cosmic consciousness.
Well, there you go. And Eddie?
Well, I'm for whoever's going to tell the biggest lie. You know, they all lie, saying what they're going to do. And whoever convinced me with the biggest lie.
Catherine, where are you from, Catherine?
I'm from Rhode Island. And
okay.
I sort of just wanted to talk about the perspective that, from my point of view, I'm a former homeless person. And we've seen a lot of people become homeless this year. We had a 16% increase in homelessness over the past year. The shelters have been constantly filled. We recently took it into our own hands as homeless and formerly homeless people, and we slept out on the state house lawn, and we're offering people spots and tents because the government was unwilling to do anything about it, or the people, the service providers, weren't willing to accept that there was a problem. So we went on the lawn. We were out there for a month, and they basically at first just tried to ignore us, but after a little while we got some publicity and people were realizing that there is a problem, and a lot of the folks that were staying with us were working up on Smith Street, which was about a block away, at the day labor place. They weren't earning enough to be able to get their own apartment, so they were working at minimum wage. So basically we have people who are living in the shelters working at minimum wage and can't afford the high rents in the East Coast. I mean, an average two-bedroom goes for $673 a month, and that's nothing included. And so at minimum wage, you can see if you're a single person and you're with a family, you basically cannot afford the rent. You'd have to work 100 hours to be able to afford the rent. And so we have this, you know, sort of like Rhode Island was actually voted, or statistic-wise, was the number one disparity between the rich and the poor. And so we have these people who are earning, who have large incomes, and then we have the very poor. And, like, there's no in-between. And so either you're in one category or the other. And there just isn't housing for people. And so, you know, we're just basically, you know, seeing a lot of homeless people who are working and just can't afford to pay the rents for the apartments. And I think the same thing is happening in Boston. And maybe through other larger metropolitan cities, they're seeing the same thing. On the East Coast, the housing cost has just skyrocketed. And it's left people out.
Catherine, do you have migrant worker situations where you are that you're familiar with?
We have a large immigrant community, but basically I would say that people are earning minimum wage and they're basically just aren't able to afford the rent. And they do work at these day labor places where they actually charge them to get to they might charge them $15 a day to get to work. And when you're earning minimum wage, that's a lot of money out of your paycheck. You know, and so they're basically stuck in these dead-end jobs where they're earning maybe minimum wage and they charge them for transportation, or it might be somebody who doesn't quite understand what's happening and there's a language barrier. We have a large immigrant community, so they basically are working jobs that maybe might be considered full-time jobs, but they're hired as temporary workers, so they don't get the benefits that a full-time worker would get. So we do see a lot of those things happening.
If you're not an SMI, okay, what is that? Spiritually mentally ill. If you're not, you know, a slamming addict, you ain't putting a fed in your vein. If you're not an alky in relapse, you know, if you just tell them the truth, hey, I ain't got no money, and I'm out here and it's cold, you ain't getting into the house. So you're saying, well, San Diego, I mean, it's warm out there. Guess what? Ask Teresa Estrella. She froze to death on the street. She was a 55-year-old woman. She froze to death because the city council said, well, this is San Diego. It's warm out there. We don't need to open early. We don't really need to worry about voucher programs. We don't need to worry. The lady's dead.
I think I'm struck whenever I hear conservatives talk about being taxed when they say that business people produce wealth simply because they make the investments, when actually the production of that wealth is made by the minds and hands and hearts of many other people, and business gets to appropriate the largest percentage of it. And I think that brings us to what's really, if you're talking about distribution, obviously you have to talk about the fact that all the indicators that we have in the United States and in many other places in the world as well, but particularly in the United States, that income inequality is the highest it's been since the government started keeping such statistics in the late 1940s. And wealth inequality has also risen to astronomical proportions, where chief executive officers are now earning about 420 times what the worker the lowest paid worker in their own company is earning, compared to what was 30 or 40 years ago, where you get ratios of 30 or 40 to 1 rather than 420 to 1. These are all signs that the issue is not the production of wealth, once again, but its distribution.
Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Are you a homeless person?
I am not, actually. I have the good fortune to have always had a home, and I appreciate that. But I do have a couple of questions. I'm wondering, I know a little bit about the situation here in Ithaca, but I'm curious about people's experience other places where, in effect, the government ends up, local governments end up passing legislation which, for all practical purposes, kind of outlaws homelessness. The example I have here is that this is a college town, and there are some laws in the books here that prevent a certain number of unrelated people from living in the same house, and this is to prevent certain areas of the town from having too much student housing. But in fact, it would actually technically prevent a number of homeless people getting together and trying to pool their resources in order to get a house. Also, another example is something as basic as there are actually no 24-hour public bathroom facilities in Ithaca. And there's also a law in the books, as I'm sure there are in many places, against public urination, for example. But that, in effect, makes it illegal to be homeless. I'm wondering about other people's experiences in other locations.
Well, I think there's been a general trend to criminalize homelessness. But I think you have to see that trend in the context of the structural obstacles to doing anything about homelessness. I mean, my understanding of homelessness is that it's primarily a product of a reduction in wages and a reduction in social welfare on the one hand, on the income side, and the rising cost of housing on the housing side. Now, both of those causes have, both the income and the housing, have powerful interests that benefit from the direction in which that's going. If wages are going down, people obviously are benefiting in business, as we've talked about. And if housing prices are going up, there are whole significant segments of the population that are benefiting from that. So when you try to do something about homelessness, inevitably you run up against these real structural obstacles. And what happens is that people tried for a while. They increased the temporary housing and then discovered that, people had difficulty getting permanent housing. And that the causes of homelessness were essentially also obstacles to doing something about it. And I think at some point, about 4 or 5 years ago, people simply threw up their hands and they didn't feel they could do anything about it, or the obstacles have proven to be so severe because they're so deeply entrenched in the way American politics and economics work nowadays. And their only response, I think, to what sometimes described as compassion fatigue, the fact that you might be able to give a dollar to one person, but if you see one person on each block, you begin to get pretty emotionally depleted from this, was to criminalize it. And if the homeless are the visible poor, the solution becomes not getting them housing, getting them jobs, providing them social supports, but making them the invisible poor. And that's essentially what has happened through the process of criminalization.
Hi, Susan.
Yes, hi.
Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Are you a homeless person, Susan?
I've been there with a small child who was only 3 at the time. And there's often landlords that just do not live to their side of their bargain, you know, as it were. And I myself am currently facing a nightmare of my own, because I'm afraid that I might end up in the boat I was some years ago. So you can see that this is an issue of many, 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 many multifaceted issue. And it does affect the problem, as the people read earlier. It does affect everybody. It affects the children's learning. There's reasons, of course, legally for the landlords to have this ability to evict people without having to give a reason, but for people who do not deserve it, who behave themselves, and should it just be because they don't want to deal with repairs anymore, or whatever the reasons may be, a personality or something, to throw somebody onto the street for no reason when the rent is paid and the place is upkept. How many other people are there like me? Others have it even worse. But I've been there, and I never forget. So I wanted to say that when we start working on revitalizing our communities and see that this, the whole nation, is, I heard what you said earlier about capitalistic society, and that somebody said that there's necessarily going to be a fringe of the poor. And I come to think maybe that's what it will always be like. I heard the man talk about India earlier, and I heard people say that people sometimes just don't want to do better for themselves. Most mothers that I know, unless they're very, very, very sick, most parents want nothing better, nothing more than their children be safe.
Susan, we had a caller earlier who said that the homeless in Portland want to be homeless.
Yes, that's what I recall somebody saying that. Obviously, I can't speak for everybody. I think that some people are so far gone, so numb from their experiences, for whatever experiences they've had, they don't know how to extract themselves from their own misery. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's no helping hand. No one who has, agencies cannot substitute for human kindness.
I met an old acquaintance on the street yesterday, a man from the other side of the cusp with whom I worked at a prestigious auto sales dealership for nearly a decade. I spotted him before he met me and said, "Hello, John." He was walking rather quickly, as most New Yorkers do. Like his Wall Street peers, John was pinstriped suited with spit-shined shoes. Visibly taken aback, he obviously did not recognize the street bum who uttered his name and abruptly replied, "Do I know you?" "You certainly do," I answered. He opened his eyes wide as if to take a second look at the miserable creature in front of him. After all, he thought, what could he have in common with a low-life street tramp? In calling out his name, I had shook John like a morning alarm clock. Seconds later, his sleepy countenance metamorphosed. His face lost its you-are-bothering-me arrogance. His mouth fell agape. My identity was seeping through to him like smoke through a screen. He dropped his mahogany briefcase to the ground and whispered, "Oh, my God, it's you," and gave me a heart-pounding hug. Like long-lost friends who suddenly find each other after years of countless inquiries, we embraced. I slept underneath a street tarp last night, and by 8 a.m. I was starving. I asked John if he would be kind enough to buy me something to eat. Over breakfast, I told John that for the past 10 years I'd been living on the streets, in shelters and in missions, that I'd slept on park benches and was assaulted by hostile youths, and that I'd survived on soup kitchen food. After nearly 2 hours of encountering my life since I left the dealership, John asked, "But why? What pushed you into this? Did your mother die unexpectedly?" he queried. "Are you HIV positive? Did you have a nervous breakdown after spending years institutionalized and were ashamed to come back to work? On and on he speculated about drug abuse and then about my apparent alcoholism. Why did you leave a promising career and durable friendships for a will-o'-the-wisp life on the streets? I've got to know. You owe me that much. I love life, John, I blurted out. I spent too many hours on the job, too much time working for material goods and the other niceties that money can buy. Sure, I kept up with the Joneses, but at what price? The effort it took dominated my consciousness so completely that I dismissed my mortality like a useless card in a poker game. Hell, I'd be the first to tell you that life out there is a bitch. I'm often cold, and my stomach is empty, and my legs buckle in the most inopportune places. But look closer, my friend. Look beyond my tattered clothing and past my weather-beaten face. Pausing for the transcendent moment, I then said, I'm finally free to be. Unencumbered by money, no longer a slave to the material world, I am infused with the joy of bum living.
What would you like the people of America to know about your situation that maybe people don't understand?
You too, huh?
What are you thinking? That's everything, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that was a laugh line, but, you know, it's
all right. Last thing I can say is you have to be yourself out there. It's like a jungle, baby. You can step and get popped, and that's the end of it.
Uh-huh. Phil, what would you say?
I'm about on the same chord you are, John. I couldn't put it any better.
This crackdown began after a young white woman was struck in the back of the head with a brick on one of the fanciest streets in New York City, on Madison Avenue. Now, it just happens that this young white woman is from Texas, the state of Governor George W. Bush, who's one of Giuliani's great friends and may possibly appoint Giuliani to attorney general if Bush is elected. The mayor, a couple of days after this woman was struck in the back of the head, went on his weekly radio show, announced that it was a black homeless man who the mayor described as deranged who had done this, and announced that he was going to command the police to begin literally rounding up and arresting people simply for being homeless. So what's happening here now is that based on this campaign for the Senate and for the president, the mayor is going beyond anything that's been done before in the city. And of course, while most people, myself included, wouldn't be against a dangerous person that's attacking someone, homeless or not, being arrested. What's happening here now is that completely nonviolent, non-criminal, totally innocent people that just happen to be homeless, including women with children, are being rounded up and arrested every single night, forced into homeless shelters, which are as awful as it is to sleep on the street, and I've been homeless, I know what it's like. I've slept on the street in the winter. The homeless shelters in New York City really don't have a lot to recommend them compared to a cardboard box. So these people are being forcibly taken to these shelters, but it does not end there. The mayor's persecution of them really only begins once they get to the shelter, because based on his new policies, they are forced now to work in exchange for their shelter. So in exchange for a cot to sleep on and some institutional food, they basically have to work the equivalent of a full-time job, no wages, no money, no benefits, certainly, and certainly no future. If they refuse to work, they're thrown back out of the shelter. If they happen to be a woman with children now, the mayor is instituting a new policy of taking their children away from them. The level of persecution is beyond anything that's happened here before.
that one of the more expensive problems that homeless people have is foot problems. You know, when you're wearing the same shoes day after day after day, you're not able to change your socks. You're you're specifically walking into foot problems that can get very expensive. I've known a number of people that have had feet amputations, you know, specifically because of it. And then, of course, you get into SSI and you get into all sorts of social programs that people with missing limbs get into that, and specifically all for want of a sock, you know, the foot was lost.
Let me tell you all something. I am out here. It's now about 5 or 6 degrees in Champaign.
Yeah.
I'm in my Tabernacle of Truth, which is my little broadcasting booth here. And I don't have a heater. I don't have anything. I want to be as much like a homeless person as I can be. But there's one way in which I'm, so to speak, cheating. I can't really do it otherwise, which is that I have some boot warmers in my boots. Because even with 5 pairs of socks on, it is simply too cold for me to do this broadcast without being able to move around. I can't walk. I can't warm my feet up that way. So, Dave, when you say that socks are an important thing for homeless people, I can tell you that that is the thing that hits me the hardest is what is my feet. I could not function without the boot warmers.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I can remember a time when I was in Denver. There was a snowstorm that hit. It was probably 15 below zero. And I was driving a diesel car, and I had to didn't have any additive in that diesel, and I had to drive it around for hours just to make sure that the the fuel wouldn't freeze up. And I saw, I can't tell you how many people I saw that night that were just like walking ghosts. And it was 15 below zero. All the shelters were just stuffed full. And it was amazing that, you know, any normal city, any city that would call itself, you know, as a part of a civilization would have, would have done something to open up any kind of possible facility. But the idea that hundreds and thousands of people are out there, I mean, you know, cavemen wouldn't have they would have had logical ways of keeping warm in a 15 below, but it becomes illegal to save your own life. You know, you can't set up a tent, you can't set up any, you know, little shelter, you can't build a fire, you can't, and it becomes illegal to save your own life.